Before we start, Jess and I discuss mental health and suicide, so some content may be triggering to some listeners. If you or anyone you know is struggling, there are ways to get help in the show notes. And remember, you are never alone.
I'm Anita Annabelle, and this is The Good Chat.
No,
do you not like compliments?
I'm quietly, I'm loving it.
I love making friends. I don't know what to tell you.
I'm a psychic. This podcast is going to be a
little chit chat.
This is probably the best chat. No, that's why this is called The Good Chat. We get good chat, mate.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Good Chat. I am your host, Anita Annabelle. On today's episode, I chat with SAS Australia recruit Jessica Paris. Jessica is a force to be reckoned with. She's an advocate for at-risk Indigenous youth, a mother to 12-year-old Isaac, an athlete, and daughter of Olympian Nova Paris. But Jess's story has been rocky and unforgiving. From public breakups to a drug test that saw her with a 4-year ban from Athletics Australia, to a harrowing suicide attempt that ultimately changed her life. In this chat, Jess was so open and so honest, sharing things that a newspaper or TV screen could never do. It was simply astounding. Here's SAS recruit Jessica Paris. I can't believe you're at work. I forget that you're actually in a real life job.
Yeah. I'm a real life person.
I know. Thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk to me, Jess. Honestly, I've been watching you on SAS and absolutely, I love that show. Oh, do you not love that show?
It's grueling. To be honest, I'm really reflecting a lot more now on my experience watching it back.
Yeah.
I think because when we filmed, everything was just so full on. You had the adrenaline pumping, the emotions were heightened, and just everything was crazy at that time. And I'm sort of really reflecting on it now and, you know, the growth that I've had as a person since then has just been incredible.
Are you actually watching the whole thing back, or are there some times you're like, oh, there's no way I'm going to watch that and relive it?
No, I think I'm really enjoying it, to be honest. Like when I came back, trying to explain to my family all the crazy things that we did, I didn't have the words to describe it. So I think now being able to visually watch it over, they're like, okay, so that's what you meant when you're crawling underground, you're in a tunnel.
I know we're here to talk about SAS, but I want to talk more about you first, because your story is one of the most fascinating stories I think we've seen on the show, mm-hmm. and in a good way and in a bad way, obviously, mm-hmm. for you. You've had some severe negative experiences, but I really want to start at the beginning with you, if that's mm-hmm. okay. So you grew up in the Northern Territory, which is a lot of people in Australia, the larger population, have zero idea what that's even like. What is it like growing up in the Northern Territory as an Indigenous Australian in Australia?
To be honest, I think I've been pretty blessed to be from up in the NT and to have my grassroots and my connection to my culture up here. You know, I think it's been such a strong connection. You know, we're not so impacted by Western society as you know, a lot of Aboriginal people are down south. And, you know, it saddens me that people are still trying to hold on to culture. Do you know what I mean? And whereas up here, you know, I travel 2.5 hours in a car and I'm going out to country that is completely untouched by Western society, you know, so I can go and experience rock art and paintings and that have been painted by my ancestors that are thousands of years old, you know. Wow. So I think having that strong connection to country from a very young age, but also experiencing the heights of my mother's sporting career was pretty phenomenal, but very unusual.
Yeah, of course. And I do want to touch on that, but mm-hmm. I do want to speak about your ancestors. Mm-hmm. I know that you've said on the show that your family were part of the Stolen Generations.
Mm-hmm. I have a very, very close relationship with my grandmother, who's my mother's mum, my Nana Joan. She's she's our rock in our family, you know, someone that has just kept us all strong, kept us together. And yeah, she's just the most beautiful, optimistic woman that just has every reason to be angry at the world for what she had endured in her life. So for her to be so positive, it's really impacted me that, you know, you to always have gratitude in life, you know, to always be thankful for what you've been given, which is the opportunity to go to school, to get an education, where, you know, something like that wasn't really around in my grandmother's growing up, you know. And she was taught on the mission to be a domesticated housewife, to learn to sew, you know, and she did learn to read and write, and that's the one thing that she is thankful for, so that she could get a job to raise her two daughters as a single mother on a minimum wage, you know. So to have that out at that positive outlook on life when you have every reason, I guess, to be angry is pretty inspirational and empowering to me, you know. And so, yeah, so like I've grown up knowing my family story, you know. So my grandmother was a member of the Stolen Generation, and her mother was a member of the Stolen Generation, you know. So my great grandmother, who's no longer with us now, she was 2 years old when she was forcefully removed from her mother for the color of her skin, because she was, you know, her mother was full blood Aboriginal and her father was white. You know, so she was 2 years old, and, you know, for 13 years later, she was released. You know, they basically, the missionaries let everyone out, because that's when the war happened. So the Japanese bombed, and basically everyone had to fend for themselves. And my great grandmother had her culture stripped of her identity, her language, you know. And so she roamed the Kimberleys wearing a Hessian sack, you know, a potato sack as clothing, you know, and then eventually made her way, met my grandfather, who was a stockman, and they travelled up to Darwin. And then they had three children, my great-grandmother being one of the eldest, and my great-grandmother was sick. And the policeman came and basically said, you're unwell and you can't look after your kids. And so they took my grandmother and her two younger siblings, and my nana thought she was going on a boat ride, and she didn't come back for 14 years.
Where did they take her?
So they went over to Garden Point Mission. So, yeah, so my grandmother was basically a mother for children. You know, she, as she was growing up, you know, it was her job to raise the younger kids.
That is unfathomable.
Yeah, so it's, yeah, it's pretty, it's sad. You know, and as I said, like my nana has every reason to be angry and, you know, to, I guess, to be stuck living in the past, but she's not, you know. My grandma's such a beautiful woman. Yeah, so she's just had such a big impact on my life growing up as a kid, and more so when my mum was, you know, my mum had me when she was 18, so she was a young mum, and my grandmother looked after me from when I was probably six months of age, so my mother could go and pursue her dream and making the Australian Hockey Roos team.
Yeah, that is such an accomplishment. And your grandma sounds so, so strong. And I think one of the things that you actually said on the show is that you draw your strength from the women in your family. And I loved that.
Yeah, no, I do. I have a lot of strong women. You know, my mum grew me up as a single mother as well, for, you know, most of my young life. My grandmother was a single mum, you know, who brought up two staunch women as well. My mum's sister, my auntie Vanessa, she served in the army for 15 years, and now she works for the United Nations. And so she's another staunch Aboriginal woman that's had a big impact. And I actually didn't really mention this on SAS, and I wish that I did, but I remember my mum's younger sister when she was in the army. My auntie looked after me for a period of time, and out on the Werribee Barracks in Victoria, and she used to wake me up at 4 o'clock in the morning, put me in the car, drive me out to the barracks, put me underneath her desk, and I'd sleep there for a couple of hours. And then when the preschool opened, she'd put me in the army truck and drive me to preschool in the army truck. So
that's a bit of an adventure if you were in preschool.
So I still have fond memories of that growing up as a child when I was, you know, 4 years old.
They know that one thing about being an Indigenous person is the amazing stories that get passed down. You know how you explained your story about your grandparents. Mm-hmm. There's no way I could explain it that way. Like, I feel like that gift of storytelling is mm-hmm. is something that's passed down in generations. Would you agree?
Yeah, no, definitely. You know, we are, as Aboriginal people, we're storytellers, we're visual people, you know, and that's how you know, as I said about the rock artwork, you know, I was very fortunate that when there were times that my mum couldn't look after me or travel with me overseas as a 10-year-old kid, you know, I would come back to Australia or I'd come back up to the Northern Territory, and my mum's father, who had still, you know, had such a strong connection to his country out in West Arnhem Land, which is out sort of past Kakadu.
Yeah.
And, you know, he would pick me up, beat the horn and the troopy that he'd pick, a big four-wheel drive. And I remember, you know, I'd be crying to my grandmother saying I didn't want to go because there was no television, there was no nothing out there. You just literally had the bare essentials.
Yeah.
And so he'd pick me up, I'd get in the car and we'd travel 6 hours in the car out bush. And, you know, it was just such beautiful, untouched country. And he taught me, you know, how to live off the land, how to hunt and, you know, just being respectful and taking care of this country, you know. So having that as a very young age where, you know, I would go to all these events, meeting the prime ministers and all these, you know, people that have achieved amazing things, but then I'd also be able to go back out bush and live off the land. So I guess, you know, being able to learn to walk in both worlds was something that, you know, I was able to do from a very young age, which I'm so grateful for now.
So special. Mm. So special. And then, of course, so your mum was the very first Indigenous Australian and the first person from the Northern Territory to win an Olympic gold medal ever.
Yes, she's definitely set the bar high. You know, she's an incredible woman, and what she's accomplished, you know, she's a trailblazer for it, you know. And I think 1996 Olympic Games, when my mum won a gold medal, and I remember I don't even think I stayed awake for that game. I was asleep on the couch in my nana's lap with my head in her lap when we're watching the 96 Commonwealth Games final. And she won gold, so something that was just such an incredible accomplishment, you know, to be the first Aboriginal woman to do that, you know, to have such an accolade was incredible.
What about that time? I remember watching it. I mean, I was 10 at the time. So I actually remember seeing, or obviously seeing replays, I wouldn't have stayed up either. But I mean, at the time, I guess there's a couple of things that I'm so curious about. Do you remember what it was like afterwards, and how, because your mum became the entire country knew who she was. What was that like for a 6-year-old?
I think for me, like I had a bit of an understanding of what she'd done, but she was still just my mum, you know. And I remember when they came back, this is a funny story. I actually remember the day after my mum won the gold in Atlanta, my grandmother was being interviewed on the phone for a radio interview, and they had asked to speak to me. And this is me, 6 years old, completely sort of oblivious to everything. They said, so when you grow up, do you want to be like your mother? And my instant response was, no, I want to be a cowgirl.
I love it.
So, you know, growing up in the territory, my grandmother every Tuesday night used to take me across the road to go and do line dancing, and all I wanted to do was be a cowgirl and ride horses. So
I love the line dancing. I just wanted to be a cowgirl. Your mum was probably like, cheers, Jess.
I still remember that, like it was yesterday, you know. So, but then, yeah, like when my mum came back to Darwin, I remember they did a parade through the main street in Darwin, and like I sat in my mum's lap, and I think it was then, you know, as a kid, you sort of see the whole crowd either side of you, thousands and thousands of people just cheering on all the Olympians, you know, and to have my mum sitting in her lap in the car, and we sort of went through a big parade in the main street, and I was holding her medal up for everyone to see. And especially there were so many Aboriginal people there as well, you know, so I think that was a really proud moment, I think more so for my mum, but for me to witness that, you know, to see that what she had accomplished inspired so many other people.
How unforgettable as well. Like, you would never, ever forget that. I'm sorry, I can't get over the line dancing. Yeah. Line dancing cowgirl, that's what she wanted to be. So funny. There is one thing, I mean, obviously the accolades are amazing, mm-hmm. and she is, I just can't get over she was 24. When you were talking, I just did the math in my head. She was 24 when she won a gold medal.
Just turned 25.
I was just trying to think what I did at 25 and I was not getting a gold medal. You have said on the show, and this is something that really tugged at my heartstrings a little bit, that you really did feel like you did grow up in your mum's shadow. Mm-hmm. You know, if you had become a cowgirl, you probably wouldn't have grown up. I don't know what you were thinking, Jess. Seriously, you should have just become a line dancing cowgirl. But you did grow up in your mum's shadow. So tell me more mm-hmm. a little bit about that, because I can completely imagine that must be so mm-hmm. difficult.
Yeah, I guess it was kind of hard, you know, like I could never really find my own person, you know, and as a kid it was, you know, I was a pretty successful as a junior athlete, you know, I played at national level at five different sports growing up as a kid. So, you know, sport to me was something that I just enjoyed, but there were times that the enjoyment was taken out of that because you're constantly compared to someone else, and just the level of expectation is that you're expected to do well all the time, and you know sometimes that expectation just, you know, when you don't have fun doing something, you know, it's hard to do. You know, I remember times where it was lane five, Nova Paris's daughter, not actually my name, you know, Nova Paris's daughter, Jessica Paris. Yeah. You know, so I think it was hard, and it wasn't as if, you know, I wasn't proud to be labeled Nova Paris's daughter, because, you know, she was such an incredible person, and the significance of her achievements was just incredible. And although I didn't really understand the significance of those achievements till my later adult life, you know, it's I was still incredibly proud of her. You know, before I was 12 years old, I'd been to more than 16 countries around the world. You know, I'd lived in America, I'd lived in the UK, I'd lived in Germany for 6 months. I traveled everywhere, wherever my mum went, I traveled. And, you know, I think I did miss out a little bit of my childhood, you know, because I was always around athletes and around adults, you know, which was quite hard. But, you know, I have memories of meeting Muhammad Ali. You know, and I was 10 years old, and I met Muhammad Ali, and it was at an event that my mum was at, and Muhammad stood next to my mother because she was the only other person of colour there, and he loved kids. And I remember he held my mother next to him, and he grabbed my hand, and he held my hand. And I remember, obviously, he had Parkinson's, and I just remember him holding my hand and, you know, my hand shaking, and he just held it close to him. And I remember he hugged me, and I've got that on video as well. So, you know, I think looking back, I think, wow, you know, like all these incredible things that I got to experience, you know, sometimes it outweighed, you know, the difficult times of not being really around other kids and going to 10, 15 different schools. And so it was, I had a very, very unusual, different childhood to most. You know, it wasn't really normal that, you know, you'd get on a private jet and travel to the Trinidad and Tobago and have dinner with the Prime Minister, you know. So
no,
that was the types of the things that I did as a kid.
So you've got a son, Isaac. Mm-hmm. Considering the childhood that you had, mm-hmm. what kind of life and childhood do you want to give Isaac?
I think for me it's all about providing stability for him. And, you know, like the way that I was a kid and the way that my son is, we're very, very different, you know, in regards to, like, my son is extremely physically active, and, you know, he's almost like three kids in one, you know, but I'm extremely blessed. Like my son is exceptionally talented and gifted. And I think, you know, I just want to remove that layer of pressure off him to be a high achiever, you know, and it already is quite difficult because my younger brother, Jack, he's an exceptionally gifted kid as well, both academically and talented in his sport, you know, so he's just kicking goals in life at the moment, and he will go into the draft this year, into the AFL draft. And, you know, and just to name a few, he's been the Australian national junior champion in the 200 and 400 meters, like three years in a row. And he's only 17 years old. So extremely talented. And my son's had him to look up to.
That's so cool. What an insanely talented family you have, honestly. But your brother then, does he feel the pressure as well that you do, or do you think you felt it because you're older and you're the eldest daughter?
Yeah, I think maybe probably different, you know, like obviously I felt the heat of my mum's sporting era because I grew up in it, you know, whereas my brother and sister didn't grow up in it. You know, my mum obviously had spent a lot more time with the two of them, my brother and sister, in regards to having that stability and not moving around so much, whereas that's the difference between the two eras, I guess.
Yeah, of course.
But they grew up in her political era, which was also extremely challenging. You know, that's a whole nother chapter.
Yeah, that must have been extremely difficult.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, like with my son, it's, for me, it's all about providing stability for him, making sure that, you know, he achieves academically first and foremost, but then sport comes after, you know, because you're never promised to have, you know, to be physically fit and healthy with sport, you know. So that's why it's so important to have an education to always fall back on.
I guess the thing that I've really loved about you on the show, on SAS in particular, is how vulnerable you've been. I think, like, your life has certainly been... there's been some amazing highs, but there's also been some incredible lows. Mm-hmm. Firstly, before we kind of dive into the lows, what has been the biggest blessing in your life?
Probably biggest blessing for me, definitely my son. You know, there have been so many things that I've been through in my life, and he's definitely kept me going through that, you know, in more so... my best friend, my comfort, you know, the person that's, you know, holds your hand at nighttime. So I've been pretty lucky with that. And I guess that's why, probably my most shameful experience to date in my life was in 2019, after all the struggle and negative media that was in around with the issue with the SADA drug test that I had leading into the Commonwealth Games, which was, you know, the Commonwealth Games was supposed to change my life, you know, to show people who I am as a person, you know. So I think my life definitely crumbled, you know, and I think trying to stay strong for so long and not having anyone to talk to about how I was really feeling, and, you know, I was just so distracted by trying to stay strong for my son because I just didn't want my situation to affect him, you know. So that's just what I was so focused on every day, and so I just suppressed so much of my emotions, and, you know, I was really struggling, you know, and I was pretty much medicated for probably two years. I just figured if I just went to sleep at night, that was the time that my brain shut off from everything that had been happening, and I'd wake up and then I could just face it all again. But going to sleep was my break of just removing myself from that situation. And just so I think for me, 2019, all I remember was being carried out by paramedics from my mother's house, and you know, that was pretty I was pretty disappointed in myself, to say the least, you know. It was, although, you know, it was a cry for help. You know, I needed support. I needed someone to talk to, and that's just what I didn't have. You know, and to think thinking back then that that was the only way out for me. That was just, you know, I was completely broken. I was in a dark, dark place, and I couldn't see gratitude in anything, you know. And that's probably what I am the most ashamed about, is that I thought that I had nothing to live for, whereas I had everything to live for, and that was because of my son. You know, he needed me. So I think watching that episode, my son did see that, and that was pretty heartbreaking for me. But I remember he, I sat down next to him, and yeah, he grabbed my hand and he helped me, and he said that he loved me. And he asked me, he said, "Did you do that because of me? Did I make you sad?" And I said, "No, you didn't, son. You know," I said, "that sometimes when you're an adult, you go through things in life, and you may not see that you have a way out, but you do, because there are so many people around you that love you." You know, so I said to him, "If you ever feel so sad, you know that mummy's always here for you, and I just want you to know that I'll never, ever, ever leave you alone in this world." So that was, yeah, that was pretty hard. Because I knew that if I didn't speak to him about that, that, you know, maybe a kid at school might have mentioned it to him. So I think it was important that that came from me.
Thank you for sharing with that with me. I think, like, when you hear other people's stories and you hear that you've really lived it, and you came out the other side, essentially, you were never alone. You've always got people, and I can't even begin to imagine how you could have been feeling to get so low and to just go, you know what, this is the only way.
I was completely numb. You know, you stop feeling. You know, and you just lose all sense of hope and having anything to live for, you know. And so, yeah, so that was hard. But, you know, I was then given support that I needed, you know, a person to talk to. And I think it was also hard for my mum as well, as she knew that I was struggling, but it was something that she tried to stay strong within the situation as well. So, you know, it deeply impacted her as well, not just myself.
When you took the pills, and please, if you don't want to answer this, but when you took the pills, did you know that you'd survive, or did you honestly just think this is
my ending? To be honest, I took so many that I didn't care.
Oh, Jess.
So, you know, that was, I didn't care.
I can't even imagine. And for your son to now see that on television, has he asked questions since? Because
no, I think, you know, like, Isaac's, his mind goes a million miles an hour. You know, so I think he's one of those kids, he's quite distracted easily, you know. So I think we brushed on it, and, you know, I just wanted to leave it at that I loved him more than anything, and he makes me so happy. You know, he said that to me. He's like, "Mum, do I make you happy?" And I said, "You make me so happy, son. You know, you make me so happy, and you are the reason why I'm here every single day, is for you." You know, so I think just reinforcing that, and he was happy with that, you know. And he's very affectionate, very affectionate towards me. And, you know, for a 12-year-old boy who thinks they're cool, which he, you know, he is pretty cool amongst his peers, you know, he's a good kid. He's such a big heart, you know. Although he's just so freakishly talented and gifted, he's the kid that will help the other kid if they can't do something, you know, and he's just got such a big heart, and he still holds my hand in the shopping center and, you know, gives me 4 kisses before he goes to sleep at night and,
wow.
you know, 2 hugs and says he loves me 5 times. So, you know, whilst he still does that, I'm embracing it.
That is so gorgeous. I actually have this cousin who has been always like cuddling me and sitting on my lap. He's a lot younger. He's only in year 9, I think. And
yep.
I remember saying to him when he was 12 years old, I said, Cammy, when will you stop hugging me? When will you stop? And he goes, when I'm 21.
Well, it's true, though. I think girls are much more, you know, fierce and independent, and boys are mummy's boys, you know. I think until they're, maybe 30 years old and they're man child. What is the term used? A man child?
Man child. Mama's boy, man child. I love that though, because he seems like Isaac seems like such a sensitive soul. That's what I love.
He is. He's got such a big heart. He's really caring, and you know, and he actually has such a close relationship with my grandmother as well. And where we live in Darwin, he actually, when he rides his bike to school in the morning, he always stops in at my nan's house, and she's waiting at the top of the veranda, and he'll say hello, either come in for a drink of water and give her a hug and a kiss and pat the dogs, and then on his way to school he goes.
He's so gorgeous. So, oh my God.
He is. He's very beautiful. And I think that's just something that kids these days don't have enough of. And
no.
as an Aboriginal person, you know, our knowledge is only passed down through story. You know,
exactly.
And that's why for me it's so important that my son has a good relationship with his elderly family.
Mm.
You know, and that's where he's going to learn. You know, that's how things get passed down is through our older generation, and kids need to put their phones down and listen to stories more.
Absolutely, you heard it from Jess. Totally, I'm so with you. I'm such a storyteller myself, as you could probably imagine. But my mom is such a big storyteller, and I think that's the European in us because we're Spanish. That's just
I find similarities. You know, you'd probably know you'd have a really big
family.
And everyone's super close and in each other's business. And same.
Yeah. It's sad though that there's a lot of stoicism surrounding all of Australia. You know, a lot of people, they just have that real, you know, oh yeah, she'll be right kind of thing. And mm-hmm. I think they don't ask a lot of questions and they don't tell a lot of stories. And I think that's really sad. And I think, you know, that also kind of leads back to the mental health issue, is that we have such a terrible ideal when it comes to this country with mental health that it's not widely spoken about enough. And, you know, there's such a stigma around it. Whereas, you know, you were so desperate at the time that you needed help and you couldn't even speak up and say, I am this desperate. Please help me. Like, I feel just, it just needs to change in this country personally.
No, I completely agree. And even more so, you know, being a young Aboriginal woman, it's hard. It's hard to ask for help sometimes. You know, you have that sense of pride as well. And, you know, for me, it was kind of showing emotion was almost a weakness, you know, so I had to try and suppress those emotions and put a brave face on every day. And, you know, I now know reflecting on that, that could have essentially ended my life.
Oh, Jess.
You know.
It just wasn't meant to be that way though.
Definitely not. I'm extremely thankful that I got the support that I needed. And, you know, I'm here today and I've got a great job, which is, you know, working with Aboriginal people, and something that I'm extremely passionate about is helping others.
I don't want to bring you back into these dark moments, but I feel like you're one of those people that have learned so much from these moments. So when you were banned from athletics for 4 years, I mean, did it feel like your identity was taken away, or do you feel like your life pivoted to be where you are?
Well, I think if anything, you know, there's not much that someone could throw at me and I wouldn't be able to get through. You know, it's definitely made me a very resilient person, you know, although it has taken its toll on me to some capacity, you know. And you know, I guess for me, the reason as to why I started back running was, you know, I was going through another low point in my life, and I just found, I found fulfillment in running. You know, I never knew if I was ever going to be any good at it, you know, but it was just something that made me happy, you know. So I guess, you know, to be, and, you know, and then I ended up running well, you know. So I guess to feel that, that such sense of pride and enjoyment and fulfillment, and then to that to be taken away from you, you know, it was hard. It was extremely hard, you know, and I did feel a loss, a sense of lost identity as well, you know. And I guess there was just so much negative media painting a picture of somebody who I wasn't, you know. And I guess that's one of the reasons as to why I wanted to do SAS. You know, I only got around had about 7 weeks to prepare before going on the show. And, you know, there are others that had been training months in preparation for the course. And so for me, I, you know, prior to that, I'd lost motivation. You know, I you know, didn't have any sort of fire in my belly anymore, you know, although I was content with making sure that, you know, my son got, had every opportunity for him to excel in life. But, you know, I guess I lost a little bit of a part of myself. And yeah, I, as soon as I got the call to ask if I would be interested, you know, there was no hesitation. It was an absolute yes. And I'm so, so happy that I did do it.
So you didn't apply, they just approached you?
Yeah. Yep. So I got asked if I wanted to go on. And firstly, had you seen this, the last year's season, do you know what you're going to be doing? And I actually did. I watched last season and I actually said to myself, if I was given this opportunity, I would absolutely do it. You know, like, I'm all for physical challenges, pushing yourself to your absolute limits. And I think, you know, I'd pushed myself to my absolute mental limits, you know, with all, you know, with all the things, adversity that I'd been through, you know, when I've come out the other side. But yeah, it was more mental and a physical challenge for me. And that's why I did it.
I'm sitting here still in disbelief that you would do it willingly. And then, honestly, like, who would do that willingly? Like, I don't know.
You know, I think one of my biggest fears going into it, as well as, you know, something my mum was quite fearful of, was me putting myself on a public platform to be criticised again, you know. But these days, it doesn't matter whether you're doing something positive or if it's negative, you're still going to be criticized.
Absolutely.
You know, there's still going to be the naysayers. There's still going to be the keyboard warriors. And, you know, it's a minority. And, you know, the opinions that matter to me are the ones that matter. And that's my close circle of people.
And I mean, SAS is a redemption story, let's be honest. But at the same time, you know, it's not, I feel that it's the best kind of redemption story because it gives you the opportunity to tell your story and it gives your opportunity to tell your side of the story. And that is what I think is the most important thing, because you're right. You know, the media, they're the ones who decided what your persona was. They said, oh, you know, you, the drugs. And then they said, you know, the very public breakups. Good Lord, you poor thing. You know, we haven't even talked about that. And the media has decided for you that this is the way you're going to be portrayed. What is it like having your entire life opened up like that? And then, and how does that affect you?
You know, I think it was horrible. You know, and I think that that's, that for me was also emotions that I suppressed and I hadn't faced. You know, it was something I just bottled down. I just didn't look at social media. I went off social media. I completely removed myself from that situation, you know, and I just publicly didn't speak about anything, you know. And I think that that definitely had impacts on me, you know. It was hard, you know. And I think what SAS does to you is it basically, if you're there for the right reasons, you'll benefit from it. You know, if you're there for the self-growth, the personal development, if you're there to come face to face with your demons, it will tear you down and it will rebuild you. And that's exactly what it did.
And I think my favorite episode is the, they ask you what you're most ashamed of. I mean,
how powerful was that whole, what was it, that room? Talk to me about being in that room.
Oh, sorry, you just gave me goosebumps then. You know, I think I'm so honoured to have experienced the show with such incredible human beings. Mm. You know, each and every one of us has come from a life where we've had to overcome challenges and obstacles and get through the other side. You know, each one of us had our own story, you know, but we were all good people, you know. And it was hard because a lot of us hadn't spoken about the challenges that we'd been through. Like some of us didn't even know my story until I shared my story with others, you know. And I actually remember Sammy Burgess coming up and giving me a massive hug, you know, and he just said, you know, you don't ever do that again. You've got your boy, Jess, you know. And he's just such a big, gentle giant. And I have just so much time for Sammy. He's just a really beautiful person, as each and every one of us, you know. And especially Jet, you know, he was a very quiet person during the show. And I think that's what the course is designed to do, is it's designed to break you down and to bring out all these emotions and that you never knew existed, you know. And so I think Jet really opened up as well. And yeah, he's another person, beautiful person, and with such high achieving parents like myself, I think we had a lot in common.
And also Jet had gone through with his sister Jamie, which is just so devastating.
Yeah.
I'm actually interested, you and Sam have a beautiful friendship. Do you think the media did wrong by Sam? Because he's been absolutely, his persona has just been destroyed.
Yeah, I think, you know, as a person of, you know, that has also had an image painted by the media, it's definitely hard. It's hard to rebuild that, you know. Like if I Google my name, there's 30 pages of crap that comes up, you know. And I think that when something negative happens in your life, it's a story that sells, you know. And so media just, yeah, and they forget that you're actually a human being with feelings.
Yeah.
You know, you're a person that has feelings. And like myself, you know, the media had a lot to do with the reason as to why I was at such a low point, because, you know, my whole life, I'll never forget when my stuff was happening, it was leaked to the media. And there was a double page spread in one of the newspapers, and they put a photo of my son in there.
Oh, Jess.
You know, so that for me was just, it was devastating. It's like, leave me alone, leave my son alone.
Leave my son
out
of it.
We are people as well, and we're human beings with feelings, you know. And yeah, so it was, I definitely feel for Sammy, but I think that this has given him an opportunity, like all of us, to show people who we are. And it's just such a raw and vulnerable moment, you know, for each and every one of us. And, you know, I hope that our stories can resonate with others.
I truly think that that's the case. I think that's why SAS is so phenomenal in the way that it runs. And obviously the DS I love the DS. I know that they come across quite aggressive and a little bit. I've had Billy on this show and I'm obsessed. He is just one of the best people that I know. Honestly, he is like, and whenever you text him, he like gives you like little emojis back. He's so
he actually gave me such a good nickname on the show.
Oh, what is it?
I was Tiny Temporal Pocket Rocket.
I love him. He probably loved you even more because he's got a daughter around your age, I think. She might be a bit younger.
Yeah, I think that's why Billy sort of took me under his wing a little bit. I think out of all the DSs, I think, yeah, favoritism, I think he was my favorite. You know, he was always the one that gave me so much encouragement, you know, and throughout the course. So I think he was pretty proud of me. It definitely gave me the kick that I needed.
It's funny that they show you, like, it's because they never show that, obviously. I mean, sometimes they do. It's like when when Bonnie's in the ice and they and Foxy goes like in the ice, which way do you sit on the toilet? She's like backwards, and Foxy's face, like, so you see glimpses. And even Aunt, when Bonnie left,
that was really interesting because you could tell Ant just switched. Like, he just went, I'm so proud of you. I'm so all of these things. And I feel like I don't think we see enough of that human side of them. But obviously we shouldn't, because they are there to do a job and to, you know.
I think they, from, well, you know, my experience with the DS is that they are some of the most incredible human beings that I've ever had the opportunity to meet, you know, and what they've endured and what they've been through during their time serving, you know, for their country was just, you know, you don't understand how they, I can't comprehend how they are still such positive people, you know, when they've been through and they've seen things that would probably be enough to break a person down, you know, but their outlook on life and their perspectives on certain things, and they're just incredible, and they are there to help you and to bring the best out on you. And, you know, they may seem harsh and tough, but it's only then when you start being complacent and comfortable, you stop learning, you stop pushing yourself, you know, you get comfortable. So it's only sort of, you will progress when you're in the uncomfortable, and that's exactly what they do. And it's only really now, my reflections, is that I can really see that, and I'm so grateful for it.
Now that you're not being pushed out of a plane or plunged into ice water, you're like, oh, yeah, that was a really growing experience. Good for me. And with the SAS, I guess one of the biggest challenges that I really struggled watching was you had that insanely sad story of your stepdad who passed away in a car accident, and then you had to plunge into water in a car. I mean, take me back to that moment.
Yeah, I so for me, like, water is something that I find uncomfortable, you know, in the best of times. Like, I'm not a very confident swimmer.
Well, you didn't grow up around it.
No, see, for me, being in the top end, water meant crocodiles, and that just was a no for me.
It's a no from anyone.
Yeah, I've just never been comfortable. I've always been a land lover. I'm comfortable with being in control and having 2 feet on the ground. And, you know, that's probably all about my learning experiences, is getting over those fears of water and being uncomfortable, you know, learning to be comfortable in the uncomfortable. I remember going into that challenge thinking, yep, no worries, I can hold my breath, I can do this, you know, just listen to the detail. And I think Billy actually said that he looked in my eyes and you could just see fear. You know, I was just, I was sort of just completely switched off, that I forgot about what I was actually supposed to do, because my mind was elsewhere. And I remember going, as soon as the water sort of leveled up, I just had a glimpse, you know, of my stepfather. And he died in a tragic car accident in 2012. And he was the big male influence in my life growing up as a kid. So Daniel and my mum met at the Sydney 2000 Olympics. He was a 400, 200 meter runner. So they met, and they were quite close in age. So he was more like a big brother to me, you know, but we had an extremely close relationship. And obviously him being the father of my sister and my brother, and I was absolutely devastated when the accident happened. And the impacts that it had on my family were pretty difficult as well. And another story is that Yana Pittman and Daniel were actually really close friends as well. So Daniel and Yana went away on multiple junior athletics championship trips together, and the two of them were very close. You know, and I've actually known Yana from the age of 10. She was 17 at the Olympic Games when she ran with my mother in the 4x400 relay. And I actually remembered riding around the Olympic Village on Yana's scooter as a 10-year-old kid. So, Yana and I, Yana was pretty protective over me actually on the course, sort of always looking out for me. And I think, we just having such close connections, you know. So I felt pretty humbled and pretty comfortable in regard to, you know, having her there with me.
Do you spend a lot of time downtime? Like, because you obviously are doing the course during the day, and then you're fearful at night of a drill. Oh, God. That was the best drill, by the way, when they were like, something's coming, and nothing came. Nothing came. That is so petrifying to me. But yeah, do you have a lot of downtime?
We do, but usually the downtime is preparing for the next task, you know. So usually like our clothes are wet and we only get given two sets of something. Yeah. And so the kit that we wear out, we're allowed to get changed into our dry kit, but we have to get the other kit washed, dried, ready to go for the next task. So we were constantly, you're constantly on your toes. But although they do give you a little bit of downtime, and that's usually, you know, we're either stretching or, you know, just trying to get some sleep in because we didn't get much at night.
You were trying to recover from the pain of doing those big challenges.
Yeah. I think, and just also it was hard to remain calm because at any given moment the DS were going to come, you know, knocking on the door or just walk straight in and say, parade square, 1600 hours. So we had, you know, 2 minutes to get ourselves ready on the parade square and, you know, potentially get another beasting.
Honestly, I couldn't think of anything worse. I'm sitting here with heart palpitations just thinking about this. When Kobe is a duty recruit, good Lord, I have never seen anyone be such a shit leader in my life. If you could just get a pen and paper and just write that down, that would be ideal. Thank you. What was Kobe like in real life? Because I am dying to know.
You know what? I think he's sort of been portrayed a little bit negatively, you know, but sometimes people just come across differently and you don't get to sort of really see who they are as a person. And Kobe sort of off screen, he's a character, like he's a funny bloke. He's extremely honest, and sometimes people may not get the humor in his honesty. They take offense to it, you know. And I think, but if you spend a fair bit of time with him, you'd understand that Kobe is Kobe. You know, he's got an extremely different personality. You know, some of the things he says on, you know, on camera might not come across in a polite way. But yeah, that's just honestly just how he speaks. But yeah, apart from that, like Kobe and I got along fantastic. You know, I really admire the love that he has for his wife and his son. You know, he spoke a lot about his wife and his son, you know, and has invited myself and my boy over to Bali and wants to take my son surfing. And, you know, so I'll definitely take him up on that offer.
You
and he's asked to come over to Darwin and for me to take him out fishing and onto my country. And yeah, I think one thing I really liked about Cobes is that he really embraces Indigenous culture. And he has a lot of friends in Sydney that are from the Indigenous community. So I think he definitely had a lot of respect for me. And, you know, if you respect me, I'll respect you.
Of course. Do you know, I just can't imagine anyone not getting along with you. I feel like you just got along with everybody. No matter who they were. I mean, they're actually, you know, controversially, I think they're actually quite a likable cast. Sorry, I know there's probably people who are like, Anita, what are you saying to Jess right now? But I do. I think they're really quite a likable cast. And I think the great thing is that we are seeing a different side to all of them. And look, I can see underneath all of the Kobe drama.
I think he's just he's just a little bit misunderstood.
Of course. Yeah. Of course. And also there's another person. This is exactly what we were talking about before. There is another person who has had the worst name because of who he is and who he associates with. Mm-hmm. And it's just, he's still a person. He's still human. Mm-hmm. He's still got his story. And, you know, sometimes I think that in my line of work, the amount of people in this industry that I've spoken to, I guess you're kind of like, you see one thing, you know, it's a completely different story, but also you're trying to juggle who you are in between.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that's what Kobe does.
Yep. Now Kobe he doesn't think before he speaks sometimes.
Honestly, I just want to get Voltaren cream and send it to Mark Philippoussis. Because Kobe was just so like, write it down and you can get it yourself. And I was like, can someone just give the poo, please? Just give him a piece of Voltaren. I will get it for him.
But, you know, he did have a valid point there, because I was, you know, after listening to what he said last night, I think he said, you know, if you get them to write it down, then the list won't be so long.
So true.
So that makes sense.
He's actually very smart because he doesn't have to do the heavy lifting and they have to do the heavy lifting. So, oh my God, honestly, it's been such a joy to watch you. But I do, there's just before I let you go, I am really curious how you feel you've grown in this whole process. Foxy says to you, especially in the bit where you're submerged in the water, you're sat in the past. Do you agree with that? Where do you sit on that now?
I 100% agree, you know, and I think when you're stuck in the past, you have that victim mentality, you know, and I think for me, it was being able to, shit's happened, you know, but it's how do we move forward? And, you know, I can only control the controllables, and that's how I react to situations, and that's how I am today. And, you know, I think definitely it's given me strengths, learning curves, you know, and there's more failures than wins in life, you know, but it's only in failure do we actually grow, you know, so you either win or you learn. And for me, I've just been constantly learning. If you, put the negatives aside and you focus on the positives, and you're constantly learning and you're constantly trying to be a better person. And human beings, you know, as humans, we are imperfect beings. You know, no one is perfect, and we're constantly, you know, developing. And I think you have to have that growth mindset. And I think that's, you know, from my experience on SAS, it's made me a better person, a stronger person. It's made me a better mother. It's made me a better daughter, a better granddaughter, and a better partner. You know, and I just want to be able to share my experiences with other people, you know, and just to let people know that there is light at the end of the tunnel. The things that we go through in life, if you overcome them, it only builds character, you know. So, yeah, if that's something that, you know, I want to be able to help others with. What I'm extremely passionate about is obviously working with people and helping people. And I actually want to create a resilience camp for at-risk kids up here. So I think more so just being such an invested mum that's so invested in her kids' life, I think it's hard for me to see other kids that don't have that, you know, and then you sort of go off the rails and a little bit. And so, yeah, I'd love to be able to do a camp that has some of the values that we learnt in SAS, but not the yelling, because kids don't react to yelling. But to do it in a, you know, a calm and compassionate way. You know, I definitely think that a little fire has been ignited in my belly, and wanting to possibly just go back and start doing some running sessions again, which I have been since the show. Not going to put any expectation on myself, but it's a place that brought me so much discomfort over the last few years, and that I'm actually now confident and I'm comfortable stepping foot on the athletics track again.
That is so amazing. Congratulations, because that is like that, from where you were to where you are now, that is. And you know what? I have to tell you, your stepdad got you that phone call to go on SAS, I'm telling you now. I don't know if you believe in any of that, but I feel like somebody just literally went, you know what, this is going to change her life, and it needs to change. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to put her on SAS, and here she is.
Oh, 100. And I am just, I'm so grateful for the opportunity, you know, and it's something like this that is, it's changed my life forever. And, you know, I had no expectation of what would become after the show, and for me this was just all about self-development, self-growth, and challenging myself, you know, but also sharing my vulnerabilities openly, you know, and sharing my story and who I am as a person.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with me. This has been such a beautiful hour. I don't even want it to end. I just think you are just for what you have been through, where you are now, where you're heading, I can't wait to see you just bring on this next chapter. Thank you so much for being on here today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Of course.
It was lovely to chat.
Oh, you too. All right. Thank you so much. Bye.
Enjoy the rest of the show.
Well, that was such a good chat. On next week's episode, I speak to a very good friend of mine, Dr. Simon Rosenbaum, to talk about mental health in celebration of Mental Health Month. Simon and I have known each other since we were 13 years old, and I have to say he's probably one of the very first people to understand my mental health battle. So I cannot wait for this chat. And if you like this chat, you can rate, follow and review and follow me on Instagram at AnitaAnnabelle_ and at TheGoodChatPod. See you next week.